يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello and welcome to another Middle East Analysis. And the topic, when we look at the Middle East at this current time, as is on everyone's mind, is the situation in Egypt right now. To discuss this in context is our usual studio guest. That's the Bishop's Conference Consultant on the Middle East, Dr. Harry Hagopian. Harry, how are you doing?
I'm fine, James. Thank you.
Now, I want to start with Egypt. What else can we talk about, really, of course?
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we've got President Mubarak, been in power for 30 years, mm-hmm. and the people are now speaking in their actions as well as anything else. Can you give us the context?
Yes, it's almost a surprise that the people rose up and there are so many riots happening in Egypt and the people are asking for a change of president, for a change of leadership, for a change of direction and orientation in the country. I mean, things have been pretty bad economically and socially for a while now. However, things became increasingly bad over the past few years. And of course, a few months ago on the 31st of December on New Year's Eve, if you remember, we even did a podcast on it. There was a terror attack against the Church of the Two Saints, Saints Peter and Mark in Alexandria, which is a Coptic church. And that already alerted people that things aren't well in Egypt. And gradually since then, we had the uprising in Tunisia, where the Tunisian president was overthrown and he fled the country. And then it's almost like beginning to appear that the whole Middle East, North Africa region is becoming susceptible to movements of change. And following Tunisia, as your listeners would know, Egypt today is in dire straits. It's in the middle of some sort of a revolution. That's what it is being called in Arabic by many people. But it is not only in Egypt. You can already discern the murmurs of dissent and unhappiness in other countries. If you look at Yemen, if you look at Sudan, if you look at the demonstrations in other countries as well. So there is something happening in the whole region, and I don't think anybody yet knows really in which direction it's going to take us all.
Now, quoting back at you something in one of your recent articles that does look at the North African region in particular, mm-hmm. in assessment of the Middle East, you say that, simply put, men and women are at long last seeking to assert their identity and retrieve their dignity after decades of corruption, deprivation and subjugation. It sounds to me, when you're talking in that vein, that you're saying that this is a good thing, yet obviously we have to recognize that people have lost their lives in this.
People have lost their lives. There were some very, very bloody confrontations between different groups of peoples in Alexandria, in Suez, in Ismailia, in Cairo, across Egypt yesterday. But I still stand by that statement. And the reason I stand by that statement is because if you know the culture of the Middle East, it's got some wonderful points in its favor, but it's also got some very bad points that work against it. One of those is that there is a system of top-down repression, that the leadership, that the people on top basically oppress the people, make them do what they want. Human rights is not a concept that is understood in the Middle East, in North Africa, as in many other parts of the world, the way we would understand it here in Europe. And I'm not saying that it should be understood in the same way, but there are some rights which are defended both in religion as well as in secular politics, which aren't applied. And for decades and decades, the people of the Middle East, in fact, since the colonial powers partitioned the country and drew the maps and decided to give what to whom, and since then you have had before that the Ottoman Empire and the whole colonialism of the Ottoman Empire. So since centuries, the Middle East and North Africa has been prey to different people coming and imposing their will upon the local indigenous peoples. And there's always been a question that I've been asked, James, why is it when we see so many popular outbursts in different parts of the world, why isn't this happening in the Middle East? Why are Arabs not rising up? Why aren't they saying enough is enough? We can't take this anymore. Where economically, we're in very bad shape. Where politically, we're not really achieving much socioeconomically, legally, where there is discrimination, where minorities and minority communities feel sometimes discriminated against. There are a whole bunch of ills, and yet people used to tell me, what are the Arab people, is the Arab world dormant? And lo and behold, this has happened, as a commentator was saying on Radio 4 Today program on BBC Radio 4 a few days ago. I can't remember if it is Professor Eugene Rogan from the Oxford Middle East Center, but he said this is almost a new renaissance, a new revival in the Arab world, where they've had enough. And that's usually what happens. It's not a pre-planned movement. It's not something that was decided upon and then implemented. It's been much more spontaneous, and that, I think, is its strength rather than its weakness.
But then we've talked about decades of poverty and disenfranchisement. So my question to you on the back of that is, why now?
Well, that is the $6 million question. Why now? I don't think anybody knows why now. I don't think any analyst I've heard on television, on the radio, in the written press has been able to say, why did it happen now? It's just one of those tipping points when suddenly, out of nowhere, something happens, a spark that then reverberates and results in many consequences. And the spark for me was not necessarily the terror attack against the Coptic Church in Alexandria, because that was a good example of a community being targeted. But the real spark that ignited this whole movement, in my opinion, is one poor man in Tunisia who was selling vegetables on his vegetable stall, got into an argument with a policewoman, a Tunisian policewoman. They started shouting. Apparently, one slapped the other. And then he got so fed up with his life, no money, no prospect, no nothing. He has no value in life. He went and burned himself. So that example of self-immolation basically resulted in this uprising in Tunisia. We see the results of that. And then gradually, when the adjoining countries, neighboring countries, realized what was happening there, probably they thought, well, we're also in some bad situation. And then the outburst continued with Egypt. Egypt is the biggest Arab country in North Africa, so it will have consequences not only upon itself, but also upon its neighbors in the region, and certainly upon the wider world.
And we often look at the Middle East as being, obviously, in terms of the Holy Land, a place of pilgrimage. But wouldn't you say with North Africa, Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, Egypt, very much as far as a Western perception goes, they're tourist destinations, aren't they? The pyramids of Giza for Egypt and Luxor, we think of that.
Certainly.
We don't think of people necessarily destitute on the streets, unhappy with life and so forth.
Yeah, but that, James, is because these are little bubbles, cocoons. I mean, when tourists go to places across the whole world, take Latin America, take Africa, take the Middle East, tourists go to certain touristic resorts. They don't really know what's happening in the backyard of that country. Where as you go to Sharm el Sheikh, you go to Hurghada, you go to the Red Sea, you do your scuba diving, you enjoy yourself, you have fun for 2 weeks, and then you come out and you're living in a virtual world, which is not the real world most of the people are living in. Most of the people are living in very difficult circumstances, and there are a few people who are very rich, very powerful, who are literally directing the whole country, and everybody else is pretty much disenfranchised or marginalized, as you said. And this is the tipping point where I think suddenly somebody said enough is enough, and it took one person to break that psychological barrier of fear of going into the streets, because you might be shot, you might be arrested, you might be tortured in prison. And one person led to another, and then there is a huge popular mass of hundreds of thousands of people amassed in Liberation Square, which is Maidan al-Tahrir that we keep listening and hearing about in Egypt. And that basically suddenly also has very, very interesting repercussions sociologically, that the Arab-Egyptian larger regional sense of victimhood, that I'm a victim who has to accept what is being dished out, has turned into one of empowerment. If this sees its way through to a logical end of more democratic governments, more open regimes, more transparent realities, more empowerment to the people, then I think more good governance, I think this would have been an epic moment for the Middle East that we are actually witnessing today.
And finally, Harry, I'd like to look to the future a bit. You've talked about victimhood into empowerment. Again, reading your latest article on the subject, you suggest that hand in hand with the dismantling of antiquated precepts, there should be a concerted plan by local religious leaders, and I presume obviously you mean by that Christian leaders as well as Islamic leaders.
As well as Muslims, yeah.
To educate their grassroots towards the acceptance of the other. I mean, that's key, isn't it?
That is very key, and it is key across the whole Middle East, just as it is key across many other parts of the world, James. The reason I put it in that last article, which I assume you would link to this podcast, is the fact that in Egypt, about 10% of the Egyptian people are Christian Copts, largely Orthodox, but also Christian Copt. There are some Catholics and Evangelical Copts, but mostly are Orthodox. 10% means out of a population of 80 million, you're talking about 8 to 10 million Christians in Egypt. That's a substantial number of Christians for one country. And these people have suffered discrimination. They have suffered a lot of oppression for their faith as well as for their socioeconomic reality. And what I'm saying is that it is incumbent upon the leadership, Christian, of course, but also Muslim in Egypt, across the board, Christian, Muslim, and Jewish, to educate their people to accept the other, not to look at the other as an alien from another planet who doesn't have rights, but to be one who is co-equal in citizenship rights. And that's something I've always fought for, I've always spoken out for. Arab Christians and Arab Muslims are citizens of the same region. They should have the same rights and they should be treated equally. The fact that one looks at Jesus as our prophet and Lord and Savior, and the other looks at Moses and in Judaism, and the third one looks at the prophet Muhammad in Islam, does not mean that it deprives them of their citizenship rights. Governance should apply across the board, and this is one of the inequalities that I have struggled for, and I know that it is one that the church in general, and certainly we here at the International Affairs Department of the Catholic Bishops Conference, strive diligently to apply across the whole region, as your podcast and our private conversations have shown.
Very emphatically put. We'll leave it at that for the time being, but do come back and talk to us as this story develops.
We'll leave it here because the story is still an unfinished symphony, if you might forgive me the euphemism, and there is still much more to come. It will be interesting to follow this up later and see where it would lead us for the whole region.
Dr. Harry Hagopian, thank you very much.
My pleasure, James.